In the case of a 121, it's 2.5 microns thick. You'd have to pile up 50 of them or so to get to the width of one of your hairs. And a Coles 4038, which was, you know, the Ringo Starr overhead mics.
Yeah. I was shocked the first time I held one of those mics in my hand.
Yeah, if somebody put it in your hand and your eyes were closed, you'd start doing this.
Yeah.
Hey, everyone. John Dykstra here, and this is the launch of the Size of Sound podcast. I want to thank everyone for tuning in. We're going to cover a lot of acoustic topics. I'm going to help demystify acoustics for you guys. But we also, you know, we want to shine light on cool stuff that's going on around Nashville and in my hometown of Milwaukee and really beyond. We're going to spread our wings and fly a little bit here, you guys. I want to go to venues. I want to focus on cool bands that are doing cool stuff and just show you cool records that I love and talk to really neat people that are in the industry. We're going to talk to people who aren't in the industry because acoustics isn't just for studios. There's home theaters, there's audiophiles, there's all sorts of different uses for acoustic panels. So buckle up. We're going to talk about all those things. Today though, what are we doing? I'm going to talk about bass traps. So that's kind of the biggest thing about acoustics, particularly for studios and theaters and the music end of things. So we're going to talk about bass traps. I'm going to talk to my friend John Jennings. He's the president of Royer Labs Microphones. Really excited about that. Royer microphones are some of the most premier in the world as far as I'm concerned, specifically for certain applications. But I want to get in depth with him on that, where he sees Royer in the market and where they shine and what the best uses for his products are. We're also going to talk about the evolution of this space, the one that I'm sitting in right now. We've got two rooms here. There's the room I'm sitting in now. That's going to be the more audio-focused suite. And then right next door over here, we're going to have a video suite. And that's where all of this content's going to be created and mixed and edited and beautified. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Size of Sound podcast. What does that mean? Size of sound. It's sort of the aha moment for me personally, when I really started to kind of wrap my head around what acoustics means. And wavelengths are how sound propagates through medium, and air is how we usually think about it, but it'll go through solids and water and all that as well. But the wavelengths of sound each have their own specific size. High frequencies are a couple of millimeters, 20 hertz, the lowest frequency we can hear. That's 50 feet, like literally takes 50 feet for that wave cycle to happen. And understanding that difference in that relationship, if you think about water and, you know, you toss a pebble in a pond and it makes a ripple, like those ripples are pretty weak. Those are high frequencies, right? So if we put some carpet on the floor or some drapes on the walls, we can mitigate high frequencies because high frequencies are very weak. But bass, on the other hand, think about, you know, the waves that people surf on. Those things have a lot of power. There's a lot of force behind those waves. There's a lot of force behind bass. So it takes a lot more to control bass than it does to control treble. Not even just how it's controlled, but how it reflects around a room. There is a point where this sort of study or this thought process of imagine being set in the middle of a forest of pencils. Very odd sort of thing to think about, but there's all these very small things around you. What would that sound like? Well, pencils can reflect sound, but because they're so small, the wavelengths that will recognize that pencil are also very small. So there would be a lot of really high frequency reflections coming back at you from this forest of pencils. As the pencils get bigger, the reflections that those objects, we'll stop calling them pencils, the more frequency content that'll come along with that reflection. So you start looking at a huge wall. A lot of frequency content can reflect off of a wall that has no texture. But you start putting wainscoting on that wall, or you put a little bit of texture on that wall. All those little changes in that big surface are going to start putting a signature on how the sound is going to reflect off of that surface. We're going to talk a lot about the size of sound as this thing develops and what it means, how we dissect it, and how we make sense of it, and how we fix it. We'll be right back. Hey, everybody. This is the Size of Sound podcast. Today, I'm joined with John Jennings, the president of Royer Labs Microphones. How are we doing today, man?
Doing great. Good to be here, John.
Good to meet you.
Good to meet you, too.
A mutual friend of Dave has put us together here so we can chat a bit about stuff. President of Royer Labs. How long's that been the case?
President for about a year. I'm one of the founders of the company,
cool.
Myself and a couple other guys. And my business partner, Rick Parada, who was the president for years, retired.
Okay.
And so it just made sense. Took his spot, bought his shares, and here I am.
Here you are. Yeah. How long's Royer been around?
We opened in 1998.
Okay.
And we were writing business plans the year before that and sort of coming up with the whole concept of what we were going to do. And, you know, you have to dial in a company and dial in your overall strategy ahead of time. Just at least have an idea of where you're going. And of course, it always changes direction, but we got off to a good start.
Yeah. So like, what was that? I mean, what was the impetus of Royer? Like what was the market missing? What did you guys have that nobody else was doing? Like,
let me go back a little bit in order to answer that. In my 20s, I was a guitarist in the Philadelphia and New Jersey area and made a living playing. Did a fair amount of studio work, nothing that you've heard of, but, you know, for friends and, you know, different sure. projects. And, I used to love the sound of the amplifier in the room. You know, of course, you have all this stuff. I had a Marshall and a Boogie and good cabinets. And then I'd go in the control room and you'd sort of get this almost pinprick of the sound through a 57 or through some condensers that just didn't capture the body and the weight and everything of those guitars. And I was, you can get some pretty good sounds out of that pinprick of a sound with a 57.
Sure.
And that's a good place. It's in just the right place for good rock guitars. And, but so much was missing in my original tone. It was frustrating. So cut to years later, I met Dave Royer. We started our first company, which was making condenser mics and compressors and things. And we died. You get your mistakes out of the way.
Sure.
We were gone in less than a year, but I learned so much from that.
Okay.
But during that time, David started talking about ribbon microphones. And he was frustrated because nobody wanted to even listen to what he had to say, myself included. I was like, ribbons, come on, man. Those are those big clunky things you used right. to see Frank Sinatra singing it to. You dig them out of garbage cans if you're, you know, if you feel inclined, but, you know, it's probably better to just leave them there and it's, you know, they're over. But what I learned from Dave was that ribbons hear more like the human ear than any other kind of microphone type. The more I heard, the more that message started sinking in, the more interesting it got.
Sure.
And then I read this article where Eddie Kramer talked about every recording that he did of Jimi Hendrix having a ribbon on the cabinet.
No kidding.
Yeah. Okay. Amongst other microphones, but
sure.
that was part of it. And that was kind of mind blowing. So I started paying more attention to what Dave had to say. And then Dave cooks up the first R121.
Okay.
And it was like, oh, and it was a modern ribbon. It was, you know, much smaller, sleeker, you know, much less weighty. And, you know, we took it around to some studios and tried it on some things. And I was like, oh, Dave, you know, I think you could change the world with this because there's so many frustrated musicians, guitarists,
right.
trumpet players, you know, who are wailing into a mic and it's coming out sounding like it's piercing, but a trumpet is beautiful.
Right.
Cello and violin players, you know, who are trying to capture something really authentically and, you know, the high E string on a violin will get kind of shrieky, but they're not playing it that way.
Mm-hmm.
So when you've got a microphone that hears things very much like your own ears are hearing them, it's very predictable and you can get that full experience if that's what you're looking for. That's not always what you want.
Yeah. That recording is an art, right? I mean, we always talk in the acoustics world where the control room, I know what the goal is. The goal is transparency.
Yeah.
The goal is to hear the speaker as pure as you possibly can. But then when people are asking me for advice on how they might treat the recording space, well, all bets are off. That you're an artist in there, right?
Yeah.
I mean, what's totally wrong for one thing is perfectly right for something else.
I've seen it so many times.
So how can I give you the advice on that? There is no advice on that. The advice on that is learn how to be an artist.
Yeah.
You know what it is?
So part of being an artist is trial and error.
100%.
That's part 100%. Of the creative process.
So why, I mean, is there a digestible nugget that you can tell me why the ribbon mic is closer to the human eardrum than any other type of microphone?
No, it's it's technically it's nothing like the human ear. The human ear is a diaphragm,
sure,
essentially the eardrum. The ribbon element is hung in space at two points, upper and lower, and it just sits there and moves in relation to sound pressure.
Okay.
But the way that that translates in a well-designed ribbon microphone is extraordinary. Now, here's something interesting. You know, ribbons dominated in the 40s, 50s, mm-hmm. But the big industry then was not records, it was TV.
Okay.
And it was broadcast. And so the microphones that did better in that world did better overall. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're hanging a 9-pound RCA 44 over, you know, a soundstage. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, you know, you're given a condenser mic that weighs 5-6 pounds less.
Right.
That has more output because ribbon microphones were dynamic. They had no electronics inside to give you high level. So, condenser mics were lighter, easier to work with, and they had more high end built. A capsule has a high end bump.
Sure.
It's just intrinsic to the design. Mm-hmm. And, that was really helpful when you were working with tape back then because tape tends to soften and compress. And the more times you run it through, if you're recording music, you're losing high end as you go. So you want to hit it with extra high end.
Right, right.
It's when we moved to digital recording that that extra high end became a real problem because you didn't have tape helping to clean that up, soften, compress, make it more musical. Mm-hmm. Suddenly it's like, whoa, that harshness is really hard.
Yeah.
And that's – and fortunately – Royer came along right as that was happening.
Yeah,
no, a lot of frustrated engineers.
Good point. Yeah.
Yeah. They told us, hey, man, I feel like I'm back in analog.
If you've got a desert island list of things you want to put on a guitar cab, that's the mic. And
thanks.
I always kind of think Royers and ribbons, but also that R121 especially, it's almost like the benchmark of, hey, I've made it. Well, because, you know, everyone needs a kick drum mic. Everyone needs an SM7. Everyone needs a couple of overheads. Everyone's going to kind of get the basic toolkit. But, like, you know, you need your large diaphragm for a number of things around the studio.
Yeah.
And then there comes that day where it's like, I'm going to grab a 121 because, man, it just, like you said, it really makes that amp sound like it doesn't when you're in the room, when you're setting the tone and getting everything dialed in. And then you go back and you sit at the chair. That's the mic that it's like, well, yeah, that sounds like home.
It does. Yeah. Sounds like you're sitting in front of your amp. I'll tell you something interesting. We've all gotten so used to the sound of a 57 on a cab. On a clean guitar, it doesn't make much difference, but on a distorted, you know, rock guitar,
right,
or even just a tasty sort of edge of distortion, I know, for something clean, getting a little 57 in there is nice.
Yeah. Is that your, like, second favorite guitar cab mic? Because I think I know what your first is.
Well, yeah. My first is the 121, and my second is Vance Powell has showed me some recordings that he did with 67. And knowing where to put that 67 is to die for, man. It's really nice.
Yeah.
Of course, that's a pretty pricey mic. Not everyone's going to take a 67 and then put it on a cab.
It's a great second favorite to have.
It's a really good second favorite. For guitars, I would go with that just based on what I've heard from Vance. But, of course, he's such a great engineer.
Yeah.
He's going to get that sound. But a 121 is so authentic to the sound of the amplifier. And then if you want that rock edge, that sort of mid-range fist that a 57 gives you and a little bit more bite in the highs, which is built into that mic to help cut through those early Shure PA systems.
Sure.
So it's still in that mic, and that extra bite combined with the power and the mid-range and all that authenticity of the 121 – It's a great blend.
Yeah.
You put the two together.
Very cool.
But if it's a clean guitar thing or jazz guitar thing, just the 121 is fine. And it's even fine, you know, on the distorted guitars. You miss a little of that edge if you don't have it there. We even built a clip to hold a 121 and a 57 right next to each other.
Keep that right?
Yeah. Keep the phase continuity correct and throw it on a cab and away you go.
Brilliant. I want to talk a little bit, you know, when I was coming up in audio recording school and you know, we're talking 20 some years ago now at this point. The perception was basically you can't even sneeze around these things. They're so fragile, right? The ribbons are just so, so fragile. You got to kid glove it all the time. I mean, what's true there and what's not true there?
It's pretty true. In the early days, you really had to watch them. Okay. And that depends on the ribbon too. A 44, an RCA 44 could take a little more level than some people, you know, think. Mm-hmm. But they were still somewhat fragile. Wind is the enemy. And a Coles 4038, which was, you know, the Ringo Starr overhead mics,
yeah,
or overhead mic.
And they weigh so much. I was shocked the first time I held one of those mics in my hand for the, I was like, wow, I've seen it a million times, you know?
Yeah.
And then somebody handed me one to put up on a boom stand and I was like, you're going to need a different stand, my friend. This thing is.
No kidding.
It's a brick.
Yeah. If somebody put it in your hand and your eyes were closed, you'd start doing this.
Yeah. Holy cow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Workout.
So I guess what we're going to get to the point here, though, is that the Royers maybe are not quite as sensitive as some of those early ribbon designs.
Like any high-end microphone, you've got to treat it like a high-end microphone.
Sure.
You wouldn't throw your 67 in a mic drawer, just clunk.
Like a 57. Right.
Right. You don't do that. You know, yeah. 57 you can drop. You don't want to drop one of these. So the reason that the older ones, and many of the current ones too are considered fragile is because of the corrugation method. You have a ribbon element, which is suspended at two ends. And this is in the case of a 121, it's 2.5 microns thick. That's, you'd have to pile up, 50 of them or so to get to the width of one of your hairs.
No kidding.
Yeah. I mean, they're really thin. And if you were to take one like this untreated and, you know, just do that, it's going to shred. Even the ribbon that goes in a 121. But there's a corrugation process that makes it, instead of hanging straight, it gives it a shape,
okay,
a curve. And what RCA used to do was take a ribbon element, put two glassine sheets of paper on either side, and then run that ribbon element through a set of gears. So the set of gears would mesh. You'd have a little tray. You put the ribbon through, just crank this handle, and it comes out the other side. And then you peel off the glassine paper, and you have a wavy shape. And that can hold up pretty well.
Okay.
Sitting there, and that wavy shape allows it to move. It's kind of like a slinky now instead of, you know, just a flat piece of metal.
Mm-hmm.
But that is somewhat fragile. And I mean, some people won't even lay the older ribbons on their side because over time, even the weight, the
sag,
minuscule, yeah, weight, you'll get a sag.
Yeah.
What we did at Royer is, the prior president, my business partner, who's retired now, lucky guy. He designed this corrugator. These things are like about $6,000 a piece. He had these aerospace, cut gears that are perfection, and everything is on micrometer adjustments. It takes a while to get this thing right, but it's so precise that you can run the ribbon through without glassine paper.
Okay.
So what happens is you end up with many more very tight corrugations, and they all take the shape of the gear on the way around because this is a very thin metal going thump over this gear and then thump over the next. And the gears have to be so close that nothing moves out of place, but if they are just like, you know, atoms, you know, closer, the ribbon's going to shred. So they come out very tightly corrugated. And when you work with metal, if you say you go to Sears and get your Craftsman tools, I used to do that when I was younger. Mm-hmm. I don't even know if they're still around, but you always saw work hardened, and work hardened meant that metal was pounded and worked first. And that makes it tougher.
Yeah.
Bending makes it tougher. Mm-hmm. But on this little ribbon element, this 2.5 microns thick, you've got all these bend points direct over the gears, and you get work hardening on those bend points. So at those places where the corrugations would start to relax and give up the ghost, you got work hardened metal there.
Sure.
And a whole lot more of them. So this ribbon is super flexible. You can pound it and it always comes back.
There are Royer microphones made these days.
Burbank, California.
Every one of them.
Every one that's ever been made was made in Burbank, California.
No kidding.
Yeah.
And how many of these little gear machines do you guys have cranking elements out? Is there every Royer mic come out of the same precise little crimping machine, or is there?
No, we've got a few of them.
Okay.
We've got, I think, four for the R series mics, which are 121s and R10s and 122s.
Okay.
And for our SF mics, which are the stereo ribbon mics, we do have a mono version of that too, but they have a shorter, narrower, thinner, lighter weight ribbon element.
Okay.
And it's a different kind of a response. It's you can't stomp it quite the same way, but it's just dead flat and beautiful. That's what like Yo-Yo Ma and Joshua Bell and some of these fantastic classical players always use. And on drum overheads and stereo mic, it's just you know, it's a beautiful thing.
So what is the next one in the progression after the 121? I mean, that's where Royer got its start, and that's where it all began. But I mean, what came next? What's the history?
Okay. So the history is we started with Dave Royer and Rick Parada. The two of them co-designed that mic. Mm-hmm. I brought the first one that Dave ever made in his garage with me.
No kidding.
Pop to that at some
point. That's cool.
Yeah. Got it. That's a cool mic.
Yeah.
So it started with the 121 and the SF-12.
Okay.
And interestingly, the SF-12, we did not design the basic microphone itself. A guy named Bob Speeden in New Jersey had designed that about 10 years earlier. And Dave loved it, got in touch with Bob. Bob really liked Dave. Bob was a much older guy. Who was helping this young guy who was interested in ribbons. And when we showed him a 121 and what we were planning to do, he said, take mine.
That's awesome.
So we had the SF-12 and we released it at the same time. It's a very different microphone, very different, build, in, on the inside, but it was just a monster for drum overheads and string sections and things like that. So we came out the gate with the stereo mic that was great for sensitive stuff and drum overheads and choirs and anything stereophonic. And then the mono mic was the tough ribbon, and that was the 121.
Cool.
And then after that, ribbons, they don't have a lot of output. They're dynamic mics, like a 57 and a 121 have about the same amount of output. Mm-hmm. When you get into your phantom powered mics, now they're 15 to 20 dB hotter.
Sure.
So, there had never been a powered ribbon, and we designed the 122, which is the world's first phantom powered ribbon.
Mm-hmm.
And that went over really well. Because now you got a ribbon and you've got all the benefits of ribbons, but you have that extra level too.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things is when condenser mics became very popular, you didn't need the same amount of gain. Some of the old mic pres back in the day, way back in the day when ribbons were happening, they had a lot of level. They had a lot of gain because you needed them.
And they had a lot of sweet gain up towards the top of them too.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah.
They really did. There's a beauty up there and your great engineers are still seeking that stuff out.
Right.
The pres that were around that day were maxing out at maybe 15 dB less sensitivity than the old ones.
Mm-hmm.
So the Phantom powered ribbon really helped because you got your level back up. You're a condenser level, but it's a ribbon mic and it just, that went over really well. And then, interestingly, while that was being designed, Dave kept rejecting it. I mean, like I'm out putting it on things going, Dave, this is great. No, the cellos are slewing. You know, Dave is a big classical buff.
Okay.
So he would listen on classical music and come back and go, ain't ready. And I was like, okay, but this is taking forever. So what he did is he did his pipe dream mic. He put a tube circuit inside, instead of his phantom powered stuff. And, boy, did that show us where he was trying to go.
Okay.
So that became the new benchmark. And I think that R122 must have gone through 10 or 12 different designs, but what happened was a very special custom made transducer and electronic system got us there.
Cool. Very cool.
So that mic was released, but then later I'm thinking, so the tube, a tube ribbon, that sounds really gimmicky. A tube's already so warm and stuff, and tubes warm things up.
You're stacking warm on warm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Dave Roy was like, no, tube is not warm. Tube is maybe more real and stuff, and it can warm some things up, but really it's more dimensional, and there's just, and an engineer gets to work with full power instead of being limited by 48 volts.
Sure.
So, we weren't going to ever release that mic, but I started loaning it to friends and it was like kind of blowing their mind.
We got
to
release this mic.
Yeah. They ended up on Clapton's cabinet at one point and I'm okay. Like, and they loved it. And then, Alan Meyerson is, Hans Zimmer's scoring engineer and has been for, I think 2.5 decades. And we brought some down to him and he wouldn't give them back. He's got 5 and they're just on all this stuff on his scoring stage. All the time.
That's awesome.
And so we're like, well, we really have something here. And then Eddie Van Halen started using it and Clapton and Jeff Beck and like higher end players were going for that because it just had everything the 121 has with the sort of cool sense of dimension. It was almost like larger.
Yeah.
Do you live around here?
No, I live in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Oh, well, we'll have to work out get one to you sometime.
Sounds cool.
You got it.
So tell me about the Grammy.
The Grammy.
Yeah.
So, Al Schmidt was I almost hate using the word was because he was such a cool guy. He passed away a couple years ago, but he was really the godfather engineer for many decades. And Al was a big supporter of Royer and ribbons and helped us get the word out. Apparently, Al unbeknownst to us, was putting us in for a Grammy nomination.
Okay.
And trying to convince, you know, fellow Grammy folks to give us that technical Grammy. A company can only get that once, and it's not for a particular design. It's for the overall, whatever it is you brought to the industry.
Body of work.
Body of work, right.
Cool.
So in 2013, we got a call from the head of the Grammys, and I was like, no way. No, we got a call from his assistant. We'd like to schedule a call. It's Neil Portnow. Neil would like to schedule a call, and I told my business partner, Rick, I'm like, I think I know what this is, man. And we went up to his office, and we were told we received the Grammy.
Incredible.
And they sent us over the write-up about why they gave us the Grammy.
Yeah, yeah.
And the write-up basically said, you know, we're giving this to Royer for reintroducing the ribbon microphone, but doing it in a modern version. And it's important to the industry because it's brought the analog feel and vibe back to digital recording.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, oh. So we got to all dress in our tuxes and, you know, stay on the stage.
Rental? Or did you buy a tux for this particular occasion?
I should have bought one, man. But, you know, for consistency, we all just rented.
Well, hey, man, thanks for coming by.
Absolutely.
Really a pleasure chatting with you today.
Great talking with you too, John. Really appreciate it, man.
This is the Size of Sound podcast. We've been here with John Jennings of Royer Labs. And, hey, let's do it again sometime. We made some acoustic panels for you guys.
No way.
Yeah, you bet. So, you know, we were just talking about that technical Grammy. So we've got.
No way. That is fantastic.
There's that.
That's the original 121 that Dave made in his garage with the Grammy. That is so cool.
Oh, look at that. I love it. That's so cool.
Hey, welcome to the Size of Sound podcast. Talking with Dave here. We're sitting in our almost complete...
That's generous.
Yeah. studio at Center 615. I mean, obviously, there's no speakers here yet, although we've got a lot of the other trappings of a studio. Tell me a bit about what we got coming in the door here, Dave.
This whole studio complex here at Center 615 is a way for us to show off GIK acoustic treatment products in person. You notice the sound of your voice as soon as you walk in, let alone, you know, hearing anything out of a speaker. So it's a really compelling space that you and the designers really collaborated on to just make it perfect. That being said, it can be a challenge to get people to show up and look at panels. You know, once you get here, it's pretty great. So the strategy behind this place is, you know, us being right in the middle of East Nashville, creative community, obviously recording studio capital of the world. A lot of smaller, albeit high-end brands don't have the working capital to put feet on the street to open a showroom in Nashville. So what we've done is collaborated with so many partner brands to have a showroom here in Nashville that we house. So it's not the biggest spaces, but they're essentially acoustically perfect. And we have a bunch of challenges of, you know, especially with the Atmos rigs, because in this room, we're going to be doing an Atmos rig with Kali. In the video room, we're going to do one with Apogee and IK Multimedia iLoud. So this part of the episode, I hope we don't do very many of them because that means we get to finish the studio very quickly.
Right.
But things like mounting height speakers for Atmos and drop tile ceilings, you know, finding a spot on the sidewalls where the side fills can go for Atmos, where the rears go. Do they go on stands? Do they drop from the ceiling on stands? Do they go on the walls? I should probably let you talk.
No, you're right on the money there, Dave. And, you know, we, as designers, we see this all the time where people will be coming in and they're trying to shoehorn a studio into a room that's not designed to be a studio. And, you know, they've got very strict ideas on where sides are supposed to go and where the Atmos are supposed to go. And hey, look, if you can adhere to those rules, that's fantastic. But sometimes, you know, we got to break the rules, but that's because you're trying to do some art and we need to get you in the best place to do that art. And I think we're well equipped to know, hey, what rules are set in stone and which ones can we kind of move the needle a little bit and get off of 30 degrees. Just because Atmos says it needs to be at 30 degrees doesn't mean it has to be at 30 degrees. Right. That's just where it would ideally be.
Exactly. And then you move on from there.
Right.
You know, so with this segment on each episode, we'll be bringing in guest manufacturers to discuss exactly that. You know, we're connected with Dolby themselves. We'll have a Dolby rep here saying, if we can't get right exactly at 30 degrees, where do we put it? And I think a lot of our viewers would be interested in that as well. But one thing that, when you talked about the different spaces, is what we've set up here is what we wished all the customers would do. Which almost nobody does. It's like when you enter the recording world, you typically buy a microphone and an interface and a bunch of plugins, things like that. And then it takes a little while and you figure out your room is screwed up. One thing you mentioned before, too, is this is, again, a blank slate. If you want to bring in your own monitors and hear them in a place like that, I mean, frankly, half of Nashville will be coming by.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah. A lot of people, you know, often they're saying, maybe I need new speakers. Maybe I need new speakers. Well, maybe you should just bring your speakers here and listen to them in a room that's properly tuned.
Right. Yep.
And maybe you don't need new speakers.
Right. So let me kind of wrap us up here with just, you know, our initial partner kind of anchor brands. Mm-hmm. One of the most obvious is Argosy console. Make just the best desks, a wide range of different desks to suit the post-production and recording worlds. Right here we have the Aura 520. We've got the SSL Big 6 over there, which is a great small format mixer that also functions as, I believe it's an 18 by 18. Somebody check me, Rick Nackvie. Am I getting that right? USB audio interface, but it gives us a lot of flexibility. Obviously, all of the controllers, the UF1, the UC1, and the UF8. And then at the heart of everything we do here is the Grace 908 controller that's going to be driving our Atmos rig in this room. All of the monitors are going to be mounted on isoacoustic pucks or the V120s for the heights.
The next room, we got Blackmagic.
Yeah, a bunch of Blackmagic stuff, more varied acoustic treatment, different software that we'll be getting into, and that's where we're going to be putting the IK Media iLoud with partner brand Apogee with their new Symphony Atmos Forward interface. So, again, every episode, we're going to figure out a new problem, how we solved it, and hopefully it'll resonate with y'all. That's all I have.
Wonderful. Thanks for joining us, Dave.
I'm standing here with the TurboTrap Pro. The TurboTrap Pro is one of our premier bass traps because this little bad boy is going to hit all the way down to 40 hertz. And the lower a bass trap can reach, the better off your speaker response is going to be. Just under 40 inches tall, 39 inches to be exact. They're incredibly portable. They're very robust. They're sturdy. They work really great. They come in dozens of colors, and this top plate can be in one of five different finishes as well. People that tour around the country and record bands in different rooms in different places, they'll actually kind of fill a trailer with these. They'll use them as speaker stands so that they can be in a room that they've never been in before and sort of create this trustable environment, a trustable space. And if you're looking for help on what bass traps might work in your space, reach out to us. We got a phone number on our website. We got a free advice form on our website. We've got advisors that are willing to help you figure out all the myths of acoustic and demystify all that and get the right stuff in your space.